from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. That was the sound in Havana Friday as the U.S. Marines raised the American flag at the U.S. Embassy there for the first time in 54 years. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was there for the ceremonial gathering, the first U.S. Secretary of State to visit Cuba in 50 years.
My friends, we are gathered here today because our leaders, President Obama and President Castro, made a courageous decision to stop being the prisoners of history and to focus on the opportunities of today and tomorrow. In late 1960, the U.S. ambassador left Havana. Early the following January, Cuba demanded a big cut in the size of our diplomatic mission, and President Eisenhower then decided he had no choice but to shut the embassy down. For more than half a century, U.S.-Cuban relations have been suspended in the amber of Cold War politics. The United States has had 10 new presidents. In a united Germany, the Berlin Wall is a fading memory. Freed from Soviet shackles, Central Europe is again home to thriving democracies. And last week, I was in Hanoi to mark the 20th anniversary of normalization of relations between the United States and Vietnam. Think about that. And all that time, through reconciliation, through normalization, Cuban-American relations remain locked in the past. I thank the Holy Father, Pope Francis, and the Vatican for supporting the start of a new chapter in relations between our countries. And I think it is not accidental that the Holy Father will come here and then to Washington, the United States, at this moment.
The ceremony marking the resumption of diplomatic relations between Washington and Havana took place on the 35th anniversary of an event that many say was the opening salvo in the last battle of the Cold War, the strike by Polish workers at the Lenin shipyards in Gdansk. That strike set in motion a series of events that ultimately led to the disintegration of the Warsaw Pact and the incorporation of many of its former members into NATO. The opening of the U.S. Embassy in Havana also followed by a day, the 89th birthday, of the man generally regarded as the architect of the Cuban Revolution and the inspiration for the proliferation of leftist governments and regional integration throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. For more on that, and for an update on news and events in the region, we spoke with Tony Solo, a reporter from south of the border, via Skype from Managua, Nicaragua, Friday.
For people here in Nicaragua, the big event yesterday was the birthday of Fidel Castro.
Yeah, happy birthday.
And that's a tremendous milestone for him and something that must be much to the chagrin of the Miami Cubans who detest him so much.
And the Washington elite, too.
And for us in Nicaragua, yesterday was also the birthday of Comandante Tomas Borges Martinez.
Oh, good.
Who is one of the founders of the FSLN.
That's right.
And he had a very close relationship with Fidel Castro and wrote a book about him, about Fidel, called Un Grano de Maíz, which is well worth reading if anybody can get hold of it.
Yeah.
And that was a very special day for everybody here yesterday. And today, of course, is the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Havana.
That's right.
So that's another landmark event, and what everybody hopes will be a rapidly improving situation in the relations between the United States government and the Cuban government.
Sure.
But the key issue for people in the region is how serious the United States government is about lifting sanctions, about lifting the blockade. And Fidel himself made reference to that in a short article that he wrote that appeared in the media yesterday.
Yeah.
I think it was called Dreams and Reality, and he was in that article he mentioned the cost to Cuba of the United States blockade over all these decades,
right.
And which runs into many billions of dollars.
That's right.
And I know it was almost as if he was making a birthday wish that the United States would come to its senses, end the blockade, and make good with reparations all the damage that they've done to the Cuban people over the last few decades.
Yeah, apparently that's been documented at about $1.3 trillion in current money.
Yeah, and that's hardly surprising, is it?
That's a lot.
So let's see how this very symbolic opening of the U.S. embassy goes today, and what results from it over the next couple of months.
Yeah, for sure.
That's a landmark. But there's so much going on in the region. There's there was a big protest in Ecuador yesterday, but nothing like as big as the opposition, the political opposition who organized it had expected. They'd called for a national strike to shut down the country, and they didn't get anything like the level of support that they needed for that. In Ecuador, President Rafael Correa has been facing a systematic campaign of, sabotage is perhaps putting it too strongly, but I know a systematic campaign very similar to the campaign that's going on in Brazil and elsewhere in other countries in the region, and to try and block the implementation of President Correa's government program that has been so beneficial to people in Ecuador over the last 7, 8, 9 years. And the opposition there is kind of systematically looking for ways to stop the government implementing its program. And one of the things that they've been able to do over the last couple of months is, as we've talked about in a couple of previous programs, they've managed to slow down the passage of legislation that affects inheritance tax. Legislation in Ecuador that the government wants to extend so that it generates more revenue and is more is in President Correa's argument. He argues that it's a redistributive measure that will bring more economic justice to Ecuador, which has been the whole basis of his program ever since he came to office. And the opposition have managed to mobilize their middle class support beyond the levels that they've been able to sustain in the past, and that's what's led to their attempt to stage this national strike, which apparently, from all the reports that I read, was a complete flop.
Yeah, it's you're seeing that happen in a number of places. There. You know, it's funny too. Today is the anniversary of the first strike at Gdansk in Poland with Solidarity. It's the one that lifted Lech Walesa into prominence, and that kicked off. First of all, it happened like a year after they made the first Polish Pope in the 2,000 year history of the of the Catholic Church. A couple of years after Zbigniew Brzezinski became the national security advisor here, and you ended up with Solidarity being a wedge that took a couple of bricks out of the edifice of the Soviet bloc, and ended up leading to the end of it, basically, in 9 years. Looking at the history of it, it sounds just like one of the operations that they've been trying in Venezuela, and that they're trying now in Brazil, and in Bolivia, and all these different places, where it was actually externally induced austerity from Western banks, because they couldn't trade in their own currency. They had to borrow the money to buy things once they were allowed to trade at all in the 70s. And then they turned around and crunched the debt, forced austerity, and then they stirred up trouble in the country around the effects of the austerity. And then they brought in the Polish Pope.
Yeah, and I've always been quite skeptical about these kind of very sophisticated theorists that talk about fourth generation warfare and all that, you know, that. Yeah. Because it seems to me that the techniques that are currently being used to destabilize Ecuador, to destabilize Brazil, I mean, these are techniques that have, and Venezuela, of course. These are techniques that have been used historically, certainly since the end of the Second World War. And, yeah. And one, the most obvious examples are, of course, here in the region, the overthrow of the government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. The coup against Salvador Allende in 1973, I think it was, I don't know. And then the destabilization of Nicaragua, and mm-hmm. or the long history of destabilization against Cuba, and all the same components figure in all those attempts to overthrow governments and destroy legitimate governments, Currently, one of the most interesting examples in the region at the moment, I mean, apart from what's obviously going on in Venezuela, the economic warfare, the psychological warfare in the media, the attempt to exploit a colonial-era territorial dispute with Venezuela's neighbor, Guyana, now that they've got a center-right government in power there. And apart from what's going on in Venezuela, the most... from our point of view, from the point of view of people anxious to see progressive and radical, the consolidation of a progressive and radical agenda in the region, the most worrying case is Brazil, because at the moment, over the last few months, the opposition in Brazil have mounted a multifaceted campaign against the government of President Dilma Rousseff, and not just against her government, but against her party, the mm-hmm. Partido de Trabajadores, right. And against the former president, President Ignacio Lula da Silva.
Right. Yeah, they started on him. Well, they have to, right? Because the coming election, my understanding is he may well stand for that again, and if he does, he'll probably win.
Well, and that's the hope. And the Dilma Rousseff's popularity levels have sunk to something under 10%,
like
which is absolutely unprecedented. Right. Apart from the only other leader with those levels of support that I can remember was the previous Peruvian president. I mean, I think his name, I can't remember his name now, Garcia. And Toledo, and their historic popularity levels fell below 10%. But in the case of Dilma Rousseff, and it's very, very, it's the result of a whole series of things. In particular, the fact that Brazil seems to be the victim of a kind of a financial warfare in the international markets. And it's also the victim of the current 1-2 punch in terms of lower volumes of global trade and lower prices for international commodities, so that, and it's having to cope with what seems to be a deliberate speculative financial attack on its currency, mm-hmm. at the same time as it's trying to cope with this what seems to be a medium term a phenomenon of lower global trade and lower commodity prices, which very much affect Brazil, despite the fact that it's got a highly developed industrial sector. Right. And it's difficult not to see that as part of the West's attempt to put a brake on the development of the institutions that Brazil is trying to develop with China, Russia, India, and South Africa, the so-called mm-hmm. BRICS countries.
Right.
So there's that aspect of things. But internally, you've got a situation where the right wing, spearheaded by their media, the O Globo newspaper, and, right. and in so much of Latin America. It's the right-wing media that are the effective right. political opposition.
Privately owned media, right, exactly, by the old elites.
Yeah. Yeah, by very concentrated elites, and the elites that are very, very intimately linked to their partners in the United States and in Spain and Portugal, for example. So that and what they've been able to do is, and one of the very different things about the situation in Brazil and the situation in Venezuela, for example, is that the institutions there have not been changed or reformed to the same extent that the institutions have in Venezuela. So you still have the old corrupt elites that detest the Workers' Party and have kind of strung along with what Lula Ignacio da Silva and his colleagues were able to do in previous Workers' Party administrations, because they were incredibly economically successful. And they kind of doubled all kinds of economic indicators that had been stagnant for years under the previous political elites, for example, under Cardoso, who was the president prior to Ignacio Lula da Silva. And Brazil was stuck economically and didn't seem to be developing. And under Ignacio Lula da Silva and his policies that have lifted over 40 million people out of poverty in Brazil. And what that did was it created a huge internal market that enabled Brazil to develop its own domestic economy and not depend just on the exports to sustain its economic well-being and prosperity. But now what's happened is that as a result of the current almost recession in Brazil, and very low levels of growth, I think they might even have slipped into actual economic contraction at this point. The Brazilian opposition see their chance, take advantage of the government's weakness. And the other important thing to remember about the government of Dilma Rousseff in Brazil is that it doesn't have a natural majority. It has to strike deals with coalition partners, and most of those coalition partners are to the right of the Workers' Party.
Exactly. That's why you don't have the legislation that you've had in Venezuela and in Nicaragua and other places.
Yeah, so the situation in Brazil is extremely complicated, but I think what we're likely to see, and I hope I'm not being optimistic in saying this, is that the right wing are overplaying their hand in a different way to the way the right wing are overplaying their hand in Venezuela.
Yeah.
And the proof of whether they are or not, we'll find out in Venezuela and in the parliamentary elections, the legislative elections that are scheduled. I think they're scheduled for December this year. So we'll see. How to what extent the right wing have overplayed their hand in Venezuela, or not, and then I think a similar thing is happening at the moment here in Brazil in the case of the government of President Dilma Rousseff. I mean, she's at a very low ebb now, but I think that the configuration of political forces is ultimately on her side and on the side of Lula Ignacio da Silva.
Well, again, in this case, in Brazil, you're leading with an assault, whether it's by design or just market forces, particularly oil, for example, with the collapse or the dramatic drop in oil prices. That's a lot of the revenue that came into the state in Brazil, and so a lot of the stimulus that the left governments at both Lula and Rousseff were able to use, that money's not so available anymore. And then they agitate on the bottom. Well, you see, their economics are no good anyway. Now, what's interesting is, and then the other pressure is on the currency. Now, I think what we're seeing with China over the last few days is a response to that, because they've cut alternate deals for, they've dropped their costs for oil and gas. In any event, been able to nail it down long term in the huge deal that they cut with Russia, And so once they've locked that down, if they drop their currency, and now their goods are cheaper elsewhere, and it's sort of, you know, they don't have to worry about having to pay more for commodities as a consequence of that. And so maybe this is part of the response that that whole bloc, that the BRICS bloc, is going to do to this assault.
Yeah, and it's very complicated, isn't it? I mean, it's so easy to criticize the Dilma Rousseff government for implementing austerity policies and not being more proactive in their economic policies. Right. But the domestic political scene in Brazil is so complicated that I'm reluctant to kind of make that kind of facile criticism because.
Yeah. And yeah, they've got that federal system, first of all. That federal system, you know, like the United States, even more arcane than that. It makes it, you know, it's basically designed for an elite to control what looks in form to be a democratic government. She was actually pitching to the governors, I think, last week, trying to work some sort of political deal out.
Yeah, with some success, as far as I can gather. And she had less success in a meeting with members of the Brazilian Senate this week, but she got a reasonable response from a very important meeting that she had yesterday with the social movements in a meeting that she had with especially the Landless Workers Movement and other very important social organizations in Brazil, and they said that they. In broad terms, they supported her government, but they wanted her to change her economic policy. Mm-hmm. We'll see how things pan out, you know. But that whole issue of the assault on legitimately elected government using all kinds of underhand means, and we could go into detail about how they're trying to destabilize Dilma, for example, bringing up alleged anomalies in the expenditure of the 2014 budget, which I mean, from the kind of budgetary supervisory body, which is itself hopelessly and notoriously corrupt, and so, the nitty gritty is that what. The United States and its local allies, the United States government and its local allies do from one country to the next is that they kind of try and find weak points, try and find fracture lines that they can kind of work on and exploit. And they do it in slightly different ways in different countries. It's slightly different in Argentina, slightly different in Brazil, slightly different in Venezuela, somewhat more aggressive in Venezuela. They try to be a bit more aggressive in Ecuador and with what looks like no success at all. And the ALBA block of countries, although Brazil and Argentina aren't members of the ALBA block of countries led by Cuba, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, That includes Nicaragua, and I think it's five now Caribbean island nations. They had a meeting of their political council, I think it was on Tuesday, and they came up with a declaration in which they were very, very clear about exactly what we're talking about, and they identified the way that United States government are working with extremely reactionary local elites in Latin America. To attack and undermine and sabotage the government programs of legitimately elected progressive governments. And they set out a very clear agenda of resistance to that policy, insisting on the importance of dialogue, the importance of respect for legitimate institutions, and so on. And interesting and timely declaration by the ALBA countries, yeah. in support of the legitimately elected governments in the region.
Well, you know what, we need to see something like that from the BRICS entity, to the extent that there's an entity. And I'm thinking in terms of the BRICS Bank in particular. If the problems of Brazil's economy, to the extent that the problems of Brazil's economy rest in, for example, lower commodity prices and the assault on the currency, the BRICS bank could definitely handle that. And if they did something, if they took a page from Mercosur, for example, and used the future oil revenues to reduce a huge loan that would incentivize the economy, you know, that would spark the economy, and again, the terms being similar, where the repayment could be into developing Brazil instead of paying interest to some banks, coupled with China, say, continuing to expand its productive capacity and not worrying about a oversupply by reducing the cost of goods to Brazil, to flood the market basically with consumer goods. I think they could have a political impact, a huge political impact.
Yeah, and I think that kind of approach, activating the mechanisms that work against the Western financial and commodity markets, and is what they're going to have to do in one way or another. And you can see that in the call that Nicolas Maduro made, or the announcement that he made that he was going to work together with Russia. Russia isn't a member of OPEC. But Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, said that he is going to call a special meeting of OPEC and work with Russia to support the oil price, which is one of the mechanisms that the United States and its allies are using, their central banks and the private banks that they work so closely with to rig markets internationally. That's one of the mechanisms that they're using to destabilize the governments of China, Russia, and Brazil. And I think it's so important, and it's very important that you made that point, Don, because when one looks at what's happening to Russia and the way the United States government is framing its policy towards China, it's kind of... You can see that they're trying to destabilize Russia, which is just absolutely insane, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But if you look at the elements, and kind of you abstract out the elements of what they're trying to do to Russia, it's the same kind of pattern that you see in Latin America, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And one of the complicating factors in Latin America is that the different countries there, although they are engaged in an overall regional integration process, they do have different agendas. And you can see this in, for example, the recent visit by Michelle Bachelet to El Salvador and to Mexico. And Chile and Mexico are two of the most important countries in the Pacific Alliance, which is the group of Latin American countries that are implementing neoliberal trade policies, very much in tune with United States government trade policy. And I was quite disappointed to see that Uruguay, which is a member of Mercosur, and it has a government that's very sympathetic to, for example, to Cuba, to Venezuela. Uruguay is apparently in discussions with Chile and Mexico and I think Peru about the trade in services agreement, which is one of the kind of the unholy trinity of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, the Transatlantic Investment Partnership, and this trade in services agreement, which are attempts to foist a supranational, corporate-dominated international trade framework to very much as a weapon, very clearly as a weapon against the growing influence of China and Russia in particular. And to see Uruguay kind of flirting with that, it gives you an idea of how inconsistent the actual and how complicated the regional integration process in Latin America is, really is.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.